This is Samantha Dickens, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to Arizona History. Gunslingers of the Old West. When the West was young. The two decades after the war between the states were turbulent decades for our country. There was no rest for the restless, no moments of placidity for the placid, no home for the homeless. Westward ho toward the young and expanding frontier became the destination for those reckless of spirit and quick of trigger who could find no solace from the turmoil that beset their time and their country. You lived by your wits and your nerve, and you lived and died by your own ability to handle quickly and effectively your own revolver. If you were slow on the draw, a nameless mound in Boot Hill would be your last resting place. This was the age of the gunslinger. An over-publicized age it was, over-dramatized in both history and fiction. For instance, we have heard so much about the violent ones of our own tombstone, but has anyone paid fitting tribute to the very Reverend Endicott Peabody, who started the first church there, or the gentlewoman from Scotland who planted the rose at Rose Tree Inn, that grows today strong and hardy, perhaps the largest rose bush in the world? Nevertheless, we are proud to honor all the gunslingers of the Old West. And while we are in a Western mood, we think you'll like Ross Santee's account of the last of the wild horse herds to run free and proud over our hills. Ross was there, and he knows what he is talking about. Gunslingers of the Old West, story by Lee Franklin McCarty. It all began, perhaps, with Jesse James, who raided the border states of Missouri in the 70s, and whose relatives, the Youngers, helped him lay towns wide open and hold up the trains with rebel yells which came down from the lusty throat of Quantrill of Civil War days. One cannot speak of gunfighting without admitting it was all tied together, with Jesse being a cousin of not only the Youngers but the Daltons as well, and John Ringo of Tombstone thrown in. The gunfighter was a complex psychogenic from the backwash of the Civil War, one who would rub a sore to kick up a fight which might please the fast-draw complex or vanity. Thus we find Wes Hardin, a preacher's son, standing toe-to-toe with Wild Bill Hickok in Abilene, and the surprised Hickok looking into the twin barrels of eternity. No, sir, you can't separate the gunfighters. They were a disunited brotherhood of blue-eyed killers. Wyatt Earp learned to handle a gun from Wild Bill Hickok, as did Bat Masterson, who sopped up private coaching. Earp made history in Arizona and gave us a little of Wild Bill's spirit. Let us first say that Jesse James is the father of the gunfighter as we know him, the inventor, some say, of train robbery and bank stick-up and the wheat sack innovation to carry off the loot. Whether he knew it or not, Wyatt Barry Stapp Earp gravitated toward Arizona in the 1860s by way of Illinois when his pa, who loved good statute books and had a hankering for the law, wanted to reach San Bernardino, California. Wyatt got law and order learning from his old man and learned to shoot straight when he hunted meat for the wagon train along the old Santa Fe, and he learned the art of pistoleering from Wild Bill Hickok when Wild Bill hunted buffalo for its hide along with Bat Masterson and other men who were to become famous. Wild Bill could put a bullet into a bumblebee's flight or drop a winging sparrow with one of those pearl-handled Colts. Wyatt quit his hunting in about 73 and began roaming through the roaring cow towns of the Kansas frontier. In Ellsworth, he gained a reputation when the boisterous Texan Ben Thompson shot two loads of heavy buckshot into County Sheriff C.B. Whitney in the plaza, and then strutted and swaggered with a mouthful of foul-sounding expletives, inviting anyone to come take him into custody. He had the town treed, for sure. Wyatt Earp watched all this and told the mayor if he'd supply the weapons, he'd shut the Texan up, and he did. He walked out, slung with two .45s, and called to Ben to throw his shotgun into the road or he'd kill him. Somehow Ben had a powerful hunch and didn't want to die just then. This act of Ben backing down made Wyatt famous. Wyatt soon lit out for Tombstone with a sickly fellow named Doc Holliday because Doc had saved his life in a fight, and he was mighty beholden to this killer dentist. Later, he was joined by his two brothers, Morgan and Virgil Earp. A.M. King, Wyatt's old deputy, who gave advice on the painting of these pictures of the gunfighters, said Wyatt never claimed to have ever been a U.S. deputy marshal. King goes on to say that S.A. Andretta, Assistant Attorney General of the Justice Department, has stated that the records do not disclose any official documents or papers indicating that Wyatt Earp ever held a regular commission as a United States Marshal or deputy. King says many facts have become tangled in puzzling pages of literature. Anyhow, Wyatt did cradle a shotgun in his arm on the bullion stages and then was appointed a deputy sheriff of Tombstone by Charles Chabelle. It seems that this fellow Wyatt Earp was a pivot in the history of Arizona gunfighters. His deputyship was a powder keg in the fire, what with the horizon looming up, with old man Clanton, who came recklessly mavericking and stealing along the border from Laredo, Texas, and getting wind of an Ed Shefflin's silver find in a place called Tombstone. The old man sold off the trail-weary stock at Fort Bowie and took this money to grease the palms of one Sheriff Behan and thus set the stage for the Earp-Clanton feud. Wyatt was 31 years of age and had enough guts to run Curly Bill Brocious off the street when he found him drunk and standing in the blood of Tombstone's Marshal White. He buffaloed Curly and hauled his limp form off to the calaboose. Curly Bill was a 6-foot gunman with a wrestler's build and had a sunny disposition which broke from seriousness into a wide, freckle-faced grin. He came up from Texas like the Clantons. He was soon to become the leader of all the rustlers around the Dragoon Mountains of southern Arizona. Curly Bill is known to have slaughtered more than a dozen Mexicans who were bringing $75,000 in gold on a burro train through Skeleton Canyon. He was victorious in numerous gun battles and had many slugs embedded in his big body. He said he could feel them on cold nights when he slept under the stars. Curly was released from jail by the anti-Earp faction, who knew all the necessary legal claptrap to do so. So the stage was set for real commotion, along with trouble from Tom and Frank McLowry, Ike and Billy Clanton, and Billy Claiborne. Old man Clanton managed to get himself ambushed by irate Mexicans while stealing cattle, and so now Curly Bill took command, which all gravitated to the one historic action in the O.K. Corral gun battle. It is true that Luke Short, famed Fort Worth gambler along with Bat Masterson, did deal Monty for Wyatt at his Oriental Saloon, but they left Tombstone by the time the O.K. Corral shooting took place. Luke had met Wyatt in Dodge and was known as the Undertaker's friend. He had gambled up in Leadville, Colorado, and had learned to unlimber when in a tight spot, and showed this when he cut down Charlie Storms. Luke was a dandy and often wore a silk hat and loud trousers and sparkling vests. He became the owner of the famed Long Branch Saloon and was being forced out of business when he called for help from Wyatt and Bat, who came on the double by stagecoach. They soon had Luke back in business with their credentials, the 45 Equalizer. Luke later went on to Fort Worth, where he got into a gun battle with famed Jim Courtright and blew off Courtright's thumb and then put a hole in him while Jim was trying to border shift. Luke died peacefully in bed in Kansas City in 1893. He was 39. His friend and Wyatt's deputy, Bat Masterson, first met Wyatt at the Salt Forks of the Arkansas River in 1872. He was in the famous Battle of Adobe Walls, in which 19 hunters, including Masterson, stood off 1,000 Comanche, Cheyenne, Kiowa, and Arapaho warriors. Bat followed the life of a peace officer along the Chisholm Trail cow towns. He became a deputy U.S. Marshal in New York and worked on the New York Morning Telegraph as a sports reporter. He died in New York in 1921. Doc Holliday came along to Tombstone with Wyatt and followed the deputy about. Doc had studied dentistry in a medical college in Baltimore, and because the tubercular bug was eating him up, he went to packing a nickel-plated 45 Colt and left dead men under gambling tables from Texas to Arizona. Doc had nothing at all to lose. He never felt good and would be thrown into fits of coughing and hacking. He loved Big Nose Kate mostly when he felt in the pink, which was seldom. He almost worshipped Wyatt, which was about as close as he ever got to any religion. He was a magnificent tower of rage, as is expressed when he grabbed the 6'2" Ringo by the lapels and shouted into his face to come a-smoking the next time he hit the street. This was because Ringo had challenged Earp to a duel in the street and Wyatt had to decline the challenge due to political reasons. The artist had heard stated that the famed Texan Ben Thompson visited Arizona in the late 70s before he was killed at the Jack Harris Saloon in San Antonio, but there is nothing to substantiate this claim. Even if Ben did kill some 38 men, Arizona had enough gunfighters of this same class. Clay Allison, for another, did wander down into Arizona for a spell, to gamble and perhaps shoot up a man or two. He had killed some 26 souls, and had that rare insane courage to challenge a man to fight to the death with knives down in a grave. And Governor Miguel Otero of New Mexico writes that Clay went naked when roaring drunk in a dance hall with guns strapped about his waist and hurrahed the town and then killed the Sheriff Bluecoat. Clay was a northern hater, but his life ended by falling off a wagon and having his backbone snapped. Wyatt Earp made him back away in a showdown. There is also definite proof that Billy the Kid stayed for some time in Arizona. He was born Henry McCarty, according to the late biographer Fraser Hunt, was known as William Bonney, and left home when only 12 years of age after having killed his first man. He breezed about Mexico, where he shot and killed a couple of gamblers in Chihuahua. He finally arrived in Fort Bowie, where he also cut down three ambitious Indians and then a Negro and a white man over a doubtful game of Monte in Tucson. He joined company with a noted killer, Jesse Evans, and the two renegades then left a trail of blood across Arizona, along with a strange act of heroism by fending off an Indian raid on a solitary wagon and thus saving the family. Billy finally got mixed up in the famed Lincoln County War of the McSween, Chisholm, Murphy factions and the Santa Fe Ring and was hunted down by Sheriff Pat Garrett, who shot him in Pete Maxwell's bedroom in Fort Sumner. He died at 21, said to have killed a man for each year that he lived. But to get back to Jesse James' kinfolk, as I have said, you cannot separate the gunfighters. John Ringo was Jesse's cousin, and he swaggered about in Tombstone, the same type of action as was demonstrated by his cousins, the Youngers, and the Daltons yet to come. Ringo was a brooding killer and a tragedian in his overt actions. He was handsome and came from the refined Ringgold family of blue-blooded Kentucky stock. He drifted down through Missouri and Texas and finally into Arizona, where he made headquarters in Tombstone and fell under the lurid domination of Old Man Clanton. Ringo's grandfather, by the way, was Colonel Coleman Younger, who lived with John's three sisters in San Jose, California. Small world. Ringo loved good books and culture. He often went to the old church in Tombstone. He was a ladies' man and a dandy dresser and wore ladies' garters on his sleeves. He always wore two pistols on two separate gun belts, each of which was adjusted for fast action. He drank whiskey like Doc Holliday by the tumblerful and often said he wanted to end his own miserable existence. He told Billy Breckenridge that his family were under the misconception that he was ranching along the San Pedro and in the Huachucas. Not only did Ringo take to the notorious Frank Leslie, killer of Tombstone fame, but the Clantons and McLowries as well. He towered above other men, being 6'2" tall and wore matched ivory-handled Colts. He invited trouble and looked dangerous, as his portrait shows. On one occasion, he offered to exchange gun smoke and lead with Wyatt, but Mayor Thomas quickly stopped the trouble. On still another occasion, he held Wyatt, Verge, and Morgan at gunpoint from crossing the San Pedro River to take Curly Bill Brocious into custody. He told them to come on if they wanted to feel the bite of his gun and die on a bridge to the dirge of frogs. One day, Ringo and Buckskin Leslie went on a drinking spree, which led their horses up through the Saguaro and Palo Verde and Chaparral, stopping at every ranch. The next thing reported about Ringo was that he had been found sitting at the base of a giant oak tree staring into eternity with a hole in his head. His boots and coat were gone, as was his horse and money. His undershirt was torn to ribbons. The horse was found cropping gamma grass in a draw near Turkey Creek, with the boots mysteriously tied to the saddle. Many were accused of this killing. Some hinted that Johnny Behind the Deuce did it, and others made allusions to Wyatt. But there is doubt as to Wyatt throwing lead unless riled, and he did not operate in this fashion, as is vouched for in his cutting down Curly Bill with a shotgun, or a fair shootout with Indian Charlie, or when he killed his brother's assassin Charlie Stillwell in Tucson. The artist's attention has been focused on the fact that Buckskin Frank Leslie turned up in Oakland, California in 1924, an old man past 80, sweeping up pool tables and racking balls and mopping the floors. He slept in the back room on a little dirty cot and suddenly disappeared forever after having stolen a pistol from the owner of the pool room. There are a lot of folks who tell me to keep the women out of this bit of Arizona history. That cannot be done. Although they were not really gunfighters, they wore enough courage to be placed along with the men. Pearl Hart, for instance, held up the last stage in America in the rutted roadbed just outside of Globe, dressed as a young man. She was really a pretty girl still in her teens, with a 73 Winchester and bristling with pistols in her belt and a get-up-and-line-up for the surprise stage driver, all for about $450. Sheriff William Truman ran her down and slapped her into the Florence calaboose, where a huge crowd gathered to have a look at this daring bandit wench. Anyhow, Yuma Penitentiary was her next jailing place and held her for about a year while she reveled in her newly won fame and even signed autographs through the bars. In 1924, she was last seen a broken old woman when she visited the courthouse in Pima County to proudly tell the clerk that she was Pearl Hart in person. As for Pauline Cushman, here we have a glorious woman who originally hailed from Tennessee and worked as a Union spy for a spell. She said the boys on their ears, and then they shouted until raw-throated and fired off their six-shooters. She married and settled down in Casa Grande, Arizona, and often refereed gun battles in the street when someone had to drop a dainty handkerchief which sent at least one man to his death. She performed this rite also in the streets of Tombstone, they tell us. She was last seen alive in San Francisco, where she died. The grand old army of the Republic gave her a decent burial, and her funeral procession stretched for blocks. Arizona is not proud of all the deeds of her gunfighters, nor their women, and yet what would her wild and turbulent history be without them? And strange indeed is the fact that so much pleasure now comes from books and from TV and the movies, which reflect the proud and arrogant gunslingers almost nightly into millions of American homes, sometimes not following the actual facts, but always reminding us of the gunfighter and his time, a tempestuous epoch in Western history. The next story I have for you is from Heroes and Rogues of Arizona History. This one is called Zane Grey. Best-selling author Zane Grey loved Arizona, often featuring the state as the setting for his books and modeling his characters on Arizonans he'd met during his lengthy stays there. The love affair ended abruptly, however, over hunting regulations, and the outdoorsman author never returned to the state he had brought to a huge audience. This is by Joseph Stocker. In the spring of 1907 at Flagstaff, Arizona Territory, a man stepped off a train from the east. He was in his mid-30s, 5 feet 9 inches tall, slightly built, but giving off an aura of quiet strength. He had trim, even features, and high cheekbones. There was a trace of Indian in him. His hair was black and plentiful and parted in the middle. The man's name was Zane Grey. He had first visited Arizona the previous year and had become enamored then with what he perceived as a surviving remnant of the frontier, the true West, clean, magnificent, unspoiled. Now he was back to explore Arizona, study its people, write about them, and, although he couldn't know it at the time, have quite an impact on the state he came to love. In due course, this Ohio-born dentist-turned-author would emerge as one of the most prodigious producers of the printed word in the history of American writing. Over a career that was to last another 30-odd years, he turned out 81 books. More than 130 million copies were sold. Hollywood made well over 100 movies from them. At least half his books used Arizona settings and/or Arizonans as characters, some of them based on the people he met. He visited Arizona 20 or more times, often spending weeks or months here. Through the years, Zane Grey also was to become a controversial figure in Arizona, provoking debate to this day. The occasion for the 1907 trip was to hunt for mountain lions. Accompanying Grey was an aging but colorful character known as Buffalo Jones. In his earlier years, Jones had mowed down buffalo by the dozens and now, stricken by conscience, was dedicated to helping the species survive. He had a buffalo ranch on the rim of the Grand Canyon. Grey, still in his fledgling years as an author and the possessor of a formidable collection of rejection slips, wrote a book about Jones called The Last of the Plainsmen. A publisher said, "I don't see anything in this to convince me that you can write either narrative or fiction." Grey picked himself up off the floor, made another trip to Flagstaff in northern Arizona, and produced his first two Western romances, Heritage of the Desert and Riders of the Purple Sage. Both sold. Actually, Purple Sage was rejected at first as too bulgy. Grey did tend to run off at the pencil with long descriptions and self-indulgent philosophizing. But the wife of a publisher's vice president stayed up until 3 o'clock one morning reading it and loved it. And Zane Grey was on his way. Purple Sage got him into his first Arizona ruckus, though. The book was about Mormons, whom Grey liked, and polygamy, which he hated. He admired the Mormons' pioneering fortitude and their struggle to survive in the inhospitable environment of the Arizona Strip, that yawning, desolate land above the Grand Canyon. But he pitied the Mormon women, mistreated victims of plural marriage in his eyes. And his criticism went beyond polygamy to include what he saw as the fanaticism and greed of the frontier Mormon hierarchy. Quite a few Mormons took umbrage. One woman here told me that her mother walked out the door when Zane Grey came, saying, "You're no good," recalls Marguerite Noble, Payson historian and author of her own Western novel, Fillory. Grey came back to northern Arizona again to study the Navajos and Hopis. An Indian, Nasha Begay, led him on a strenuous expedition overland to Rainbow Bridge. They lacked the convenient accessibility of a boat ride on modern-day Lake Powell. It is widely accepted that Grey was only the third white man to see Rainbow Bridge, and he probably gave it its name. Here, he wrote entranced, was rainbow magnified even beyond dreams, a thing not transparent and ethereal, but solidified, a work of ages, sweeping up majestically from the red walls, its iris-hued arch against the blue sky. Grey wrote books about the Indians. He applauded what Candace C. Cant in her book Zane Grey's Arizona describes as the Indian struggle to retain their culture and at the same time accommodate newcomers to their land. But he thought the Indians were a dying race. The current population of the Navajo Reservation alone, some 165,000, suggests that Zane Grey may have been a bit premature. He took a look at the Mexican border in southern Arizona and cited at least three of his Western romances in that desert region. One of the Mexican revolutions of the early 20th century was going on at the time. Grey filtered his stories through the resultant turmoil and revealed in the process a rather strong distaste for the Mexicans. He liked the true Spanish, but he thought the Mexicans ruthless and cruel. He particularly faulted them for throwing out the Yaqui Indians. He felt that racial mixture, i.e. Spanish with Indian, produced corruption and degeneration, says Candace Cant. Grey settled in for a while at a cabin in Oak Creek Canyon and wrote Call of the Canyon. It had a familiar Zane Grey theme, the decadent materialistic East versus the strong, pure, honest West, a place of gutsy straight-shooting heroes and pure and wholesome heroines. Grey's dislike of the East may have been influenced somewhat by the brickbats flung at him by New York-based literary critics. They thought his themes simplistic, his stories two-dimensional, his dialogue stilted, his West idealized and romanticized. It is difficult to imagine any writer having less merit in either style or substance than Grey and still maintain an audience at all, wrote Burton Rasko in the Saturday Review. Zane Grey, of course, wept all the way to the bank. About the time of World War I, he heard of the so-called Pleasant Valley War. It was a rancher versus rustler family feud taking place in the region of the Mogollon Rim, that great forested escarpment stretching 200 miles through middle-upper Arizona into New Mexico. Grey hired a guide to take him into the rim country to hunt bear and mountain lion and try to get at the facts of the Pleasant Valley War. In the process, he took a fancy to the region. A split, tossed, dimpled, heaving, rolling world of black-green forest land. He bought three of those black-green acres from a homesteader named A.L. Babe Haught and had a cabin built below the rim. There, during the 1920s, Zane Grey sat in a Morris chair, writing on a board across his lap and producing some of his most popular books. One of his secretaries said later that he made notes for the books at the rim cabin but did the actual writing at his homes in Pennsylvania and California. The rim output totaled, it is said, 14 books in all. They included a pair of his bestsellers, To the Last Man, His Story of the Pleasant Valley War, and Under the Tonto Rim. Grey simply renamed the Mogollon Rim, reasoning that most readers wouldn't know to pronounce M-O-G-O-L-L-O-N as Mogollon. He borrowed Tonto from the Tonto Apaches in the nearby Tonto Basin. Grey had a way of putting the people he met into his books. Jim Emmett, a Mormon patriarch who for a while ran Lee's Ferry on the Colorado River, inspired the character of the Mormon patriarch August Nash in Heritage of the Desert. Emmett's son, Snap, didn't like Grey when he met him, made it clear that he didn't, and turned up vengefully portrayed in the book as Snap Nab, a mean man who beat his wife. John and Louisa Wetherill, who ran a trading post at Kayenta, appeared in The Vanishing American as a couple named Withers, operating a trading post at a fictional place called Kaibab. Now, working in the Rim Country, Grey did the same with the Haught family. Babe's son, Ed, became Ed Denmead in Under the Tonto Rim. His sister, Myrtle, became Murdy Denmead. He put all of us in some book or other, Myrtle said. Many things around Payson are named for Zane Grey. The whole Mogollon Rim region is often called Zane Grey Country. There are the Zane Grey Twirlers, a square dance group, the Kiwanis Club of Zane Grey Country, and the American Heart Association Zane Grey Division. Of course, his name is recognized on a grand scale, furthered in part by a national organization of fans, Zane Grey's West Society. Members call themselves Zanies. But not everybody worships the ground Zane Grey walked on. For one thing, fairly or not, he gained the reputation as a womanizer. Although he was married, he left his wife at home while numbers of secretaries accompanied him on his hunting trips, and it was bruited about that they didn't spend all their time taking dictation. The New Times, a Phoenix Weekly tabloid, in an article in November 1987, bluntly called them concubines of the month. Candace Cant implicitly confirms the gossip. There was a sensual side to Grey, she writes, apparent in his love of beautiful women. Once when the Payson School Board voted not to name a new school Zane Grey Elementary, replacing Payson Elementary, it was widely supposed that Grey's alleged womanizing figured in the decision. A board member claimed it had more to do with economics. The school system had a lot of letterhead and official items imprinted with Payson Elementary School and didn't want to waste them. The noisiest Zane Grey controversy of all attended his leave-taking of Arizona. Grey asked the state game commission for permission to shoot bear out of season. The game commission refused to sanction the hunt, so Grey announced he was leaving Arizona and would never return. As with most arguments, there were two sides to this one. A film crew was coming with the famous author to film his bear hunt. A good deal of money was tied up in the undertaking, but unbeknownst to Grey during the initial arrangements, the bear season had been changed. Grey thought that, considering all the publicity he'd given Arizona and all the money the movie studio spent here filming his books, he deserved special consideration. The state disagreed, and true to his word, Grey never came back. In 1939, at the age of 64, Zane Grey died. His cabin, unattended, beset by vandals, fell into near ruin. Then in the 1960s, William H. Gettle, a Phoenix air conditioning manufacturer and Zane Grey fan, bought the Grey property and rebuilt the cabin. With the help of the author's heirs, he filled it with Grey artifacts, a Morris chair with writing boards, quantities of Zane Grey books, a hunting rifle, animal heads, and, ironically, a bearskin. The cabin became a major Payson sightseeing attraction. Mel Counselor, latest of a succession of curators, says as many as 20,000 people a year from all over the world visited the cabin. In 1990, a lightning strike at Dude Creek ignited a 28,000-acre blaze, the Dude Fire, which ravaged the Mogollon Rim. Lives and property were lost. The Grey cabin was destroyed despite valiant efforts to save it. Today there is little to be seen at the cabin site, a few remnants of the cabin's rock foundation, an overgrowth of weeds, a well once dry now producing water because the trees now burned and dead no longer drink it underground. High above, just beneath the rim itself, spread many acres of blackened poles that had been green ponderosa pines. A few of the cabin's artifacts were spared, a hunting rifle, clothing, some first edition Zane Grey books, his hat, chaps, a jacket. They can be seen today in Payson's Museum of the Forest. Those things and the image of a wild and wonderful Arizona for millions of readers worldwide are what Zane Grey, the super author of Tales of a West That May Never Have Been, has bequeathed to the Arizona he once loved. This is Samantha Dickens, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.